aware that I had truly forgotten he was standing there. I think he can see this in my face because I sense his surprise. I would imagine it's a response he doesn't get very often.
"You really love that,"
he says. "Sorry, I didn't mean to take so long."
"Don't be. I enjoyed watching you."
My face goes instantly warm. I'm blushing. "Should we walk on?"
"Sure,"
he says, and we continue down the street. Now that I've started, I can't seem to stop. Everywhere I look, I see something I want to capture. A window displaying the most incredible pastries. Mounds of them on beautiful Tuscan-colored platters, arranged so artfully in the window that it must be nearly impossible for anyone to walk by without going inside and buying one. Pigeons squabble over a bread crust on the sidewalk. Two old women walk along, arm in arm, ahead of us. They are the exact same height, are wearing similar coats, one in a bright pink, one a mint green. They chatter nonstop in Italian, one not quite completing a sentence before the other one starts the next. I imagine that they are sisters, and they have talked this way all their lives. They laugh at something, and I click, catching the lines of amusement on their faces. It takes us nearly 30 minutes to reach the museum. The only reason I know how to get there is because I walked by it yesterday and ducked inside to get a schedule of hours and things to see.
"Why have you been away from it?"
he asks, so unexpectedly I have to think for a moment about what he is asking me.
"You said you've missed it,"
he adds.
"Your photography."
The label is an obvious one, but I warm at the sound of it coming from him, at the same time remembering that I can't think of a time when Ty actually called it that. My pictures. My hobby. But not my photography. I guess it stopped seeming important in the big scheme of things, I say.
"To you?"
he asks. "No. It's always been important to me."
"Then unimportant to whom?"
"My husband," I say. His gaze drops to my left hand and the wedding band on my ring finger. I can see that it isn't the first time he's noticed it. I wonder if that's why he's here with me. Because I'm safe. Not a threat. Even though it's absolutely true, it's not what any woman wants to think of herself. Reality is, however, reality. According to my Google search, he is 31. I'm 38 with a college-age daughter. He's also a celebrity. A guy who dates supermodels. If I'm looking to acknowledge any further reasons why it would never occur to me to think that he has singled me out for anything remotely resembling attraction. I actually feel a little embarrassed to find myself thinking along these lines. That's how ridiculous it seems.
"Why does he think it's unimportant?"
Ren asks, pulling me back to the conversation. I shrug. I guess because it's not really something that contributes significantly to our lives.
"Does it contribute significantly to yours?"
I don't have to think about the answer. It springs up automatically, refusing to be tamped back. Yes.
"Then it matters,"
he says, in a voice so full of conviction that I think how likely it is that no one ever disagrees with him. "What I meant," I say, "is as a significant source of income."
"Things can be valuable even when there's no monetary value attached."
"But there's that word, compromise."
"In what way?"
"We make concessions. To get along with others. To make life go more smoothly, even when we'd rather not."
"But that's when life begins to lose some of its shine, don't you think?"
he asks. "Are you saying you've never made any?"
"Concessions?"
I nod.
"I've made plenty."
"I imagine anyone who gets to where you are would have to make a few here and there."
"You have to be careful which ones you allow yourself to make. Some you can adjust to. Others are game changers."
We're in front of the Uffizi now. We walk inside and find the place to purchase tickets. I pay for mine first and then step aside and wait for him to get his. At the entrance, we hand over our tickets and start down a hallway with offshoot rooms of priceless paintings and statues. We step inside the first one. We separate at the center of the room. I wander left, he wanders right. I begin reading beneath each painting the plaques denoting the artist and the year the work was created. Caravaggio, The Sacrifice of Isaac. Bacchus, Medusa. We intersect paths again at the end of one display. Can you imagine creating something that would last this long? That people would travel from all over the world to see? I ask.
No, he says. I really can't.
I glance at him. Your work is kind of like that now. People come from all over the world to hear you.
It's not the same, he says. Nowhere near the same.
How so? He waves a hand at the painting in front of us.
This is lasting. Worthy. What I do isn't like that.
It is to some people. We walk on and continue looking at paintings, winding through a room full of marble statues, some of which sat outside for many years before being removed from the elements and housed here to prevent further damage. There are more paintings by Botticelli and Leonardo da Vinci. And then we find our way to the Accademia and Michelangelo's most famous Florentine work, David. I had imagined that it would be incredible. But anything I pictured in my mind doesn't come close to the real thing. First of all, he is more than 17 feet tall and so much wider, bigger than I had expected. The detail of his hands and feet is lifelike. I stare for a long time, studying every part, except for the part I can't look at with Ren Sawyer standing next to me. Like the others around us, we're both quiet, simply taking it in.
It doesn't seem possible, does it?
Ren says. No, it doesn't.
I read that the enormous piece of stone he used to create David sat outside in a cathedral courtyard for 25 years when its original commission fell through. Michelangelo convinced authorities that he was the man for the job. Can you imagine the work involved? How long it would take? Not even counting that. How could he end up with this from a chunk of stone? It's nearly otherworldly.
Yes, I say. I can come up with no better word for it. I think I could stand for hours, absorbing the magnificence of the creation. And even then, I'm not sure that would do it justice. We wander away eventually, both of us notably reluctant. There are more exhibits to see, but somehow, after David, it's hard to give the other works their fair share of credit. It's late afternoon by the time we leave the museum, and the sun has dropped enough that shadows dapple between the buildings. I look at Ren and say, "Do you think Michelangelo had any way of knowing how people would see his work after he was gone?"
"I doubt that he could dream its effect would be this lasting."
I hope he knew on some level the things that his creations have made people feel.
Yeah, me too,
he agrees. We talk almost none for the rest of the walk back. I keep my camera in front of me, looking for the next shot. By the time we arrive in front of the hotel, I've taken at least a couple of hundred photos. We walk through the main door and into the elevator. I can't deny feeling a little bit of a letdown that the afternoon is ending. But of course, it has to, as I knew it would. Well, I say, riding my bag on my shoulder. I hope you enjoy the rest of your visit in Florence.
You too.
Maybe we'll run into each other again, I say, even though I'm getting the feeling that he hopes that won't happen. It's beginning to feel awkward, so I decide not to ride up with him, making an excuse about needing to check for messages at the front desk. So, I say, see ya.
See ya,
he says, and then quickly ducks into the elevator. I feel a bit stunned at his departure, although I'd be the first to admit how ridiculous that is. Considering that the life I am currently on vacation from holds virtually no opportunities for anything like this to happen, I suppose I should just chalk it up to once in a lifetime, like being hit by a meteor. If Kylie ever decides to have a conversation with me again, maybe I will tell her about it, although I doubt that she would believe me. I walk over to the desk and check for messages with the receptionist, who hands me a piece of paper with a gold foil seal. I thank her and wait until I'm in the elevator to open it. Wynn Everson asks that you call her at your earliest convenience. Urgent. I glance at my watch. 4:30 p.m. here. It would be 10:30 p.m. there. My stomach drops at the tone of the note, and suddenly, real life comes crashing back in. I can't get to my room fast enough. 14. Lizzie. I immediately pick up the telephone on the desk and tell the hotel operator that I would like to make a call. I give her Wynn's cell number. Possibly 2 minutes pass, during which I can feel my heart thudding in my chest, and my imagination starts to run away with me. Finally, I hear a click, and then a ring followed by Wynn's not-so-normal sounding, "Hello?" "Hey," I say. "I just got your message. Everything okay?"
"I'm sorry for leaving that. I hope it didn't scare you, but I really needed you to call me."
"I would have called you without the urgent part," I say, smiling a little in relief.
"So how is it, Italy?"
"Amazing. Beautiful."
"Just like you thought it would be?"
"Better, actually. Is everything all right, Wynn?" She sighs, long and miserable sounding. "Wynn, you're scaring me," I say.
"I shouldn't have called," she says, sounding suddenly doubtful.
"What is it?" I ask, really worried now.
"Jason was sick last night."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Is he all right?"
"He's fine, just a stomach virus. Anyway, he wanted some ginger ale, and we didn't have any, so I drove to the store. It was like 5 o'clock this morning. I passed by your house and there was a car in the driveway."
The last few words are rushed, as if she has to make herself get them out before she can change her mind. "And?"
"Ty's car was there, too."
"Maybe Kylie came in with a friend," I start, not sure why Wynn is making such a big deal out of this.
"It wasn't Kylie," Wynn says.
"How do you know?" A very long stretch of silence hangs between us before she says,
"Because I recognized the car. It was Serena Billings."
I know the name as one of the recent hires at Ty's firm. I search for anything else that had been mentioned about her and can come up with only the fact that Ty had said she was uber smart, had recently graduated from Yale and was considered a coup for the firm. Maybe they were working there last night, and she left her car for some reason. This explanation sounds ludicrous to me, even as I'm voicing it. Ty has never brought an associate to our house to work before, so it's not exactly a habit I can draw on.
"There's more," Wynn says.
Now the misery factor in her voice is amplified to a point where my stomach clenches in a knot. "Wynn, what is it?" Even as I ask the question, dread swoops down over me, and I know somehow that I do not want to hear her answer.
"I started not to tell you. You know what they say about everyone always wanting to kill the messenger."
"You're not the messenger. You're my best friend."
"I hope you'll still say that when I'm done."
"Wynn, please."
"Okay. I recognized her car because she recently joined the Junior League. We met after a luncheon at Chez-Ma a couple of weeks ago. Her license plate is So Sue Me."
My stomach drops a few more floors, and this time I say the words through clenched teeth. "Just tell me, Wynn."
"I went to the door. I rang the bell. Ty came downstairs. He was, let's say, shocked to see me. There was someone upstairs, Lizzie. I didn't see her, but I heard her. I asked him who it was, and he told me to mind my own F-word business. I told him I would just as soon as I called you and let you know there was another woman in your bedroom."
I sit on the edge of the bed because I feel suddenly and completely sick. Like the time I had food poisoning and couldn't quit throwing up for 12 hours straight.
I didn't want to tell you, Lizzie, Wynne says, her voice breaking.
I can tell she's crying.
But how could I not?
She asks. My thoughts are spinning off in a dozen different directions, and I can't decide which one to grab first. How long has he been seeing her? Is this why he backed out of our trip? Why he worked so late? Have there been others?
I'm sorry, Wynne says. I'm really so sorry.
I open my mouth to reply, but nothing comes out.
Are you angry with me? She asks.
Of course not, I manage. Why would I be angry with you?
If I hadn't driven by there, if I hadn't stopped,
then I would have just gone on being a fool, wouldn't I? My voice breaks on the end of the question.
You're not a fool, Lizzie. You trusted him. That's not the same thing.
In this case, it is. I try for a laugh, but it just comes out bent and unrecognizable.
I'll come over there, Wynne says.
No, Wynne, you just said Jason was sick.
He'll be okay in a day or so, and I'll come.
I'm fine, I say. Really. Maybe it's not such a big surprise.
It is to me.
If I'm honest, it is to me also. On this side of it, I don't know why. It's not as if our life together has actually been together for a very long time. It didn't happen overnight, but gradually, so that it was hard to notice the extent of it on a daily basis. And still, I had not guessed this. I would not have guessed this. Naive fool that I am.
Maybe this is the first time, Lizzie.
Please don't, Wynne.
You don't know for sure.
We haven't slept together in over a year.
What?
Wynne finally asks, shocked. The silence is heavy, as if we're in a locked room and a naked person has just dropped out of the air to stand between us. Wynne mumbles,
maybe that's why he...
Don't even go there, I say quickly. Abstinence wasn't my choice.
He hasn't wanted to?
I feel suddenly ashamed, because how could anyone think that I wasn't in some way to blame for it? I had hoped this trip would be a renewal for us. A laugh bubbles up out of me, but then morphs into a sob. Once the tears start, I can't stop them. I can't even speak.
Lizzie, Wynne says, let me come over there.
I'm tempted. I am so tempted. Because more than anything, I want someone to lean on, to cry against. Someone who knows me, who understands exactly what this is doing to me. At the same time, I cannot stand the thought of her seeing me like this, witnessing firsthand the demolition of my self-respect from the inside out. Maybe in a while when I've picked up some of the pieces and started to put myself together again. Only right now, staring up at the ceiling of this room for which I had declared unyielding love just this morning, I cannot begin to imagine when that will be. Give me a bit, Wynne, I say, struggling to make my voice even and convincing. I'll call you in a couple of days, okay?
You don't need to be alone right now, Lizzie.
Actually, I say, that is exactly what I need. Be good, I add, and hang up. I stand, slowly, carefully, as if my bones have become fragile and might break at any unexpected move. I take off all my clothes and get in the shower. It's the only place I can think of to go where my tears will instantly be washed away and no one can hear me cry.
15. Ty. Damn nosy bitch. You pace the kitchen one end to the other. You rake a hand through your hair and tell yourself to calm down. What are the friggin' odds of Wynne showing up at the front door at 5 o'clock in the morning? Okay, so maybe you had been a little careless, letting Serena drive here, leaving her car parked out front? But then both of you had been a little too drunk to think that part through, which isn't at all like you. You like to cover the bases, look ahead for the pitfalls, anticipate instead of decimate. This could definitely fall under the category of decimation. You almost wonder if Wynne planned the whole thing. You've suspected more than once that she had doubts about you. Although there was a time when you were fairly sure you could have had her if you'd wanted her. But you didn't. And she had known it. And it looks like she's finally found a chance to pay you back. You had seen it in her eyes just before she turned away from the front door and stalked back to her car, all haughty superiority. You'd really love taking her down a peg or two. In fact, you're sure if you dig around a little, you can find some interesting facts about her own husband that you're pretty sure she doesn't have a clue about. But that will save for later. Right now, you need a plan for how to fix this with Lizzie. If and when your marriage ends, it will be on your terms, at your instigation, not because Lizzie's busy buddy friend sees fit to make it happen. You force yourself to put aside your anger, to focus solely on what is most likely to prevent Lizzie from believing Wynne's side of the story. And then it occurs to you, you'll do what she'd wanted you to do all along.
16. Wren. It's after 8 p.m. when I wake up. I hadn't really meant to fall asleep, but it seems to hit me like that these days. This utter fatigue that makes me feel like I have no other choice but to sleep. I'm starving. I could order room service, but somehow finding a place outside the hotel sounds more appealing. I take a shower, get dressed, and then grab a book from my suitcase before leaving the room. I'm in the elevator, headed for the lobby, when I think about her. I wonder if she's had dinner. I'm tempted to get off on the second floor, knock at her door, and see if she wants to go with me. It's not a good idea, though. I know it. I knew it this afternoon when we got back from the museum. Something told me then that the smart move would be for me to at least imply that we probably wouldn't see each other again. She's married. I'm a mess. We're not exactly the likeliest of friends. But I enjoyed her company. That hasn't been true of anyone in my life for a very long time. Not since my brother Colby, in fact. I resist pushing the second floor button. Step out into the lobby when the doors open. I walk by the front desk, glance at the keys lined up behind the clerk, and notice that hers is gone, which means she's in her room. I head for the door, and then on impulse turn back and walk over to the table where a house phone sits. I pick up the receiver and dial her room number. The line buzzes over and over again with no answer. I hang up, thinking maybe she forgot to leave the key when she went out. I walk into the street, deciding to go right. I pull my baseball cap down lower over my eyes, since wearing sunglasses at night would make me stand out more than blend in. I don't have to go far to find the kind of place I'm looking for. Small, family-run. Everything on the menu homemade. I ask for the back corner of the restaurant where I can see, but not be seen so easily. There's a candle on the table. I read my book, drink some really good wine, and eat a large bowl of tagliolini tossed with rosemary and olive oil. The story is good. I actually lose myself in it for a couple of hours. No one looks twice at me, including the young waitress who takes my order and brings my food. Anonymity is something I haven't felt in a good while. It's like stepping outside into the cool spring air after being inside all winter. I walk back to the hotel with the book tucked under my arm, feeling full from the great meal, but somehow lighter from the stretch of time during which I'd gotten lost in a story. In the lobby, I see that Lizzie's key is still not on its hook, which means she could either be back or still out. This time, I ignore my common sense and push the button for the second floor. I get out and walk to her door without examining my reasons for doing so too closely. I knock, but there's no answer. I wait 30 seconds or so and then turn to go. I hear something, though, that makes me stop and listen. It sounds like crying, and it's definitely coming from her room. Given that she didn't answer, it's clear she doesn't want company. We don't know each other well enough for me to think I have any right to ask her what's wrong. But I can't deny being concerned, so I knock again. This time I call out her name in a low voice. Silence now, but she still doesn't answer. Lizzie? It's me, Wren. Are you all right?
Yes,
she says through the door.
I'm fine. Thanks. Good night.
Good night, I say, reluctant, and yet what else really can I do? I walk back to the elevator, get inside, but just before pushing the button, step back out again. I stop in front of her door, and that's when I hear her crying again. Lizzie, you're not all right. Will you please open the door?
I'm fine.
I stand for a moment, aware that I'm about to cross a line I have no right to cross. This has all kinds of red flags waving in front of me. For some reason, I ignore them. If you don't let me in, I'm going to go downstairs and tell them I think something is wrong. Then you'll not only have me to contend with, but them as well. A full 2 minutes pass before I hear her unlatch the chain. She pulls it open, barely wide enough to peer around it, and say,
I'm okay. Thank you for your concern, but...
I push just hard enough to get her to step back and let me in. I see the surprise on her face. Maybe I've surprised myself a little, too. I close the door and stand looking at her. What happened? I ask.
Nothing,
she says. Nothing wouldn't make you look like you've been crying for hours. She bites her lower lip and looks as if she's going to cry again, despite an obvious resolve not to. Have you had dinner? She shakes her head.
I'm not hungry.
I notice then that she's wearing the hotel's white cotton robe. She doesn't appear to be wearing anything under it. She notices me noticing it and steps back, wrapping her arms around her waist.
Can you just go, Wren, please?
She walks to the bathroom and closes the door. I sit down on the sofa in one corner of the room and wait for her to come back out. When she returns, she does not look happy to see that I'm still here. She's dressed in regular clothes now, a skinny white skirt and a light blue fitted T-shirt. I actually feel a little disappointed by this.
You don't need to stay, she says.
Even if I believed you, I'd rather hang out here a while than go back to my room.
Why?
She asks. I don't know. It seems awfully quiet.
I guess you're used to a lot of noise, aren't you?
The assertion is not a compliment, and for the first time, I wonder what she really thinks of what I do.
I'm sorry, she says. I'm really not fit for company right now.
That's okay, I say. We can just hang. I'll read and you do whatever you need to do. She stares at me for several long seconds and says,
You're not going to leave, are you?
I can't hear you, I say, looking at the pages of my book. I'm reading. I feel her wanting to say something, but as if she doesn't have the energy, she goes over to the bed and lies on her side, not facing me. Now that she can't see me, I do look at her. It's easy to see that this isn't the woman I went to see David with this afternoon. That woman seemed as if she wanted to absorb every speck of beauty around her. It had beckoned something inside me to do the same. I don't know, maybe that's why I left her in the lobby, not intending to see her again. No one has made me feel anything remotely like that for a very long time. But this woman is broken. I really don't need to get involved with broken. Still, I get up from the sofa and walk around to face her. Her eyes are closed, and I can tell she knows I'm there but refuses to look at me. I squat down at the side of the bed, brush the back of my fingers across her cheeks, and say, Whatever it is, it'll be okay again. She opens her eyes and looks at me. Tears brim over and spill down her face. She bites her lower lip to keep from crying outright. That's when I stand, scoot her over, and sit beside her. I slip my arms under hers, pull her halfway up to a sitting position, and I just hold her. It seems like that's what she needs, and I'm here. We're virtual strangers. And even though I can't explain why, I don't want to be anywhere else.
17. Kylie. She should have quit before that last shot. Kylie knows her limits where alcohol is concerned, but Peyton has a way of making her agree that just one more won't hurt, when actually, Kylie knows that it will hurt tomorrow morning when she has to get up for class and sit through an English lecture with pounding temples. The bar is Charlottesville's most popular hangout for college kids. There are plenty of others in town, but Kylie and Peyton like this one because they have a live band every night of the week. Tonight, alternative rockers have attracted a whole gaggle of freshman girls to the front of the stage. The majority of them are looking at the lead singer as if they're all three-year-olds being introduced to their first lollipop. She squints a little to bring him into better focus. So maybe he's a 9 on a scale of 10, but he knows it, so in her estimation, that drops him a point or two. The music is loud. The beat of the drum and bass guitar pound in unison with her pulse. He catches her stare, and Kylie feels the jolt of electricity surge through her. Peyton walks up just then and says, "You go for it, girl." Kylie breaks the look, glancing at her friend with a "no idea what you're talking about" smile. "You've had too much tequila," she says.
"Define too much."
"Judgment impaired?"
"My judgment is working just fine, and it looks as if yours is too. At the next set break, why don't you go say hello?"
"Like I could do that," Kylie says.
"Why couldn't you do that? He just gave you the look, an open invitation."
Kylie wants to deny it, and as much as she hates to admit it, Peyton is usually right where these things are concerned. The band ends the song, and the crowd of girls up front goes wild, clapping and cheering, screaming the lead singer's name.
"Jack, Jack, Jack."
"Jack and Kylie," Peyton teases. "Shut up," Kylie says. But she's thinking he is awfully cute, and she does have a thing for singers. The band starts up the next song, and it's a minute or more before the girls up front lower their screaming enough that it becomes recognizable. It might be Kylie's favorite song ever. "Whatever the Weight" by Temporal. She closes her eyes and soaks up the words. His voice is not nearly as good as Ren Sawyer's, but he holds his own with the melody. And when Kylie opens her eyes to find him staring at her again, she decides that maybe Peyton is right. She'll hang around for a bit after the show.
18. Lizzie. My eyes open to a slit of light coming through the curtain of my room. It takes me a moment to remember where I am. Florence. And how I fell asleep. Ren. He's sitting up with his back against the headboard. My head is on his chest, his wide, well-muscled chest. My left arm is draped across his legs. I sense that he is awake, and I remain frozen for a moment, trying to decide if I am ready to confront how we both fell asleep last night. "Good morning," he says. I close my eyes again, squeeze them shut tight, as if that will make all of this go away when I open them again. It does not, however, and I manage a lowly murmured, "Good morning." It's then that I catapult myself up and off the bed. Once my feet hit the floor, I have a little trouble righting myself and sway like a sapling in a March wind. He reaches out, takes my hand to steady me, and says, "Whoa there." I back up a few steps, suddenly and overwhelmingly aware that I haven't yet brushed my teeth, and say, "I'm not exactly sure what happened here."
"Just wanted to make you stop crying, that's all."
"Thank you," I say, unable to imagine how that begins to cover it.
"You're welcome."
He stands then and walks to the door.
I'm going up to take a shower. See you later.
Yeah, I say. Later. I wait for the door to click shut behind him, and then force myself into my own shower, where I lean against the marble wall, letting the spray pound my face. I try to process everything that happened last night, one strand at a time. But my thoughts keep getting knotted up like the earbuds I use for running, and am forever untangling. Ty doesn't love me anymore. This one thought manages to sort itself out from the pile. I hang on it, letting its full meaning settle into me. I wait for the tears to come again, but this morning they don't. I feel like a well that has been drained, and now I'm just empty. It really should be no surprise that Ty is having an affair. From here, the signs are pretty clear. How little time we spend together, how distant we have become with each other, how rarely he touches me. But it is a surprise, and I just feel foolish. Foolish for giving him my complete and total trust. Foolish for never questioning the why behind all the hours he works. Late nights and weekends spent at the office. In my defense, the guy I married was deserving of my trust. I don't know at what point along the way he became the man he currently is, the one who does not deserve it. And I don't suppose that it really matters anymore. I think of how lonely I've been the last couple of years, with Kylie no longer in the house as a diversion. How utterly alone I have felt at times. And I cannot begin to even imagine how gullible I am in his eyes. Believing myself still married to the same man who had proposed to me in the delivery room right before the birth of our child, who'd had a pastor waiting outside the double swing doors, and at my yes, quickly urged him in to perform the ceremony before Kylie arrived. I don't know what happened to that boy, or how I lost him, but I have, and he is gone. I hear a knock as I'm getting out of the shower. I reach for a robe, slip it on, and open the door. A bellman hands me an envelope.
"Effects for you, signora."
He leaves with a polite nod, and I close the door, pulling the paper out and unfolding it. The fax is on Ty's law firm stationery and written in his handwriting. "Arriving in Florence at 11:30 a.m. I will meet you at the hotel. We need to talk. Ty." I glance at my watch. It's just after 9. I read the message again. "He will be here in 2.5 hours. Here in this hotel where I had thought we would celebrate our anniversary together. Now he's coming. And all it took was me finding out he's having an affair." I ball up the piece of paper and drop it in the trash can. I pick up the phone and ask the front desk for the number of the closest rental car agency. They give it to me and I dial immediately. The man who answers speaks good English, and within 5 minutes he has arranged for me to pick up a car at their main office 10 blocks from the hotel. I pull my suitcase out of the closet and methodically begin to put in my clothes. In the bathroom, I collect all my toiletries, pack them up in their clear makeup bag, and then toss that in the suitcase as well. I'm dressed with my hand on the doorknob when a knock sounds from the other side. A little frantic, I glance through the peephole, afraid that Ty will have somehow managed to get here earlier than his facts indicated. But it's not Ty standing in the hallway. It's Ren. I open the door, and he stares at me for a moment, clearly surprised.
"Where are you going?"
"I'm, leaving."
"Leaving Florence or leaving Italy?"
His voice is soft and surprised. "Leaving Florence."
"Where are you headed?"
For a moment, I'm not sure how to answer. "I just decided to get out and see some of the countryside."
"Are you coming back?"
"No. I don't expect I'll be coming back here." I hesitate, glance away, and then meet his questioning gaze again. "It was really nice meeting you, Ren, and thank you for last night. For being kind. For everything, actually." I start through the doorway, pulling my suitcase out into the hall. He stops me with a hand on my shoulder.
This wasn't planned, was it?
I consider lying, but what would be the point? As ridiculous as it sounds, it's as if he can see through my walls and already knows what I'm thinking. No, I say. Kind of unexpected.
And I'm guessing it has something to do with last night.
This time I don't answer because I don't trust myself to do so without crying again. We are quiet for a string of weighted moments. Before I can put together an answer, he breaks the silence.
Would it be all right if I come with you?
I blink, shake my head, sure I must have misheard him. What?
I'll come with you.
This time there's no question in his voice. Ren, you really don't have to. I'm fine. You're very sweet. He laughs at this, and I'm guessing sweet is something he isn't called very often.
I don't have any real schedule, so...
So, you're just going to get in a car and drive around Italy with me? He shrugs.
Why not?
I am not an unintelligent woman, and I'm fully aware this would be a moment where using my intelligence might be highly recommended. My marriage has just caved in around me. I have an either furious or contrite husband about to arrive in this city, and I do not need to be dragging a far too good-looking for my own good rock star into the middle of all of it. Of course, I'm not exactly dragging him, but even so, I try one more time. I really don't think you want to get in the middle of everything I have going on right now. It's probably best if I just head out of here alone and find somewhere quiet to think for a bit.
Probably, he agrees. But I still want to come. Give me 10 minutes and I'll meet you in the lobby.
Seriously? I say.
Seriously?
I shake my head, trying to find a convincing protest. This is crazy. People don't do things like this.
I admit it's a departure for me, he says with notable irony.
Then why? He shrugs.
Maybe the better question is, why not?
19. Lizzie. The rental is a Fiat. I'm driving. Ren is in the passenger seat, his 6'3 frame positioned accordion style with his knees pressed against the dash. He's wearing sunglasses and a baseball cap, which I noticed him pulling a little lower over his face when the woman at the car rental agency kept checking him out. I reach under my seat for the map and hand it to him. Can you navigate? He looks at it as if it's some 100-year-old relic I've dug up from a deep hole.
Maybe. Where are we going?
There's a little town I circled not too far from Florence. Could you find it? He opens the map. One edge touches the windshield to his right, the other landing midway across the steering wheel, taking up more than half the car's interior. He finds Florence, places his thumb there, and with the other hand locates my circled area. He gives me the first road name to look for. We drive in silence for a few minutes, keeping an eye out for the sign. He spots it just as I'm zipping past. I head for the next intersection, make a controlled left-hand turn, and then whip back onto the road, going back to the one we missed. We wait at a very long stoplight, and then finally cross the highway and hit the on-ramp without missing it this time. We stay on this road for 20 miles or so before Ren looks at the map and says,
"Uh-oh."
"What?"
"I think we were supposed to turn back there."
I take the next exit, swing the car around again, and find the road. We've missed the third one when Ren looks at me and says,
"How attached are you to this map?"
"We have to have a map," I say. He pulls his phone from his pocket, taps an app, types in something, and hits search. 3 seconds and it's there on the screen, a computerized voice telling us what to do next. "Okay," I say, halfway rolling my eyes. "If you can't read a map..." He balls it up and tucks it under the seat.
"Unnecessary suffering."
"Some things are better in the old version," I say.
Like?
Coke in glass bottles.
Agreed, he says, tipping his head.
Journey before Steve Perry left.
Debatable.
Harry Potter. Books were better than the movies.
Won't argue.
I consider my next answer, and then... Paper bags at the grocery store instead of plastic.
Yep. Still not giving you maps.
The GPS voice pipes up just then. 1/4 mile ahead. Stay right. He smiles, but I pretend not to see. It's 2 o'clock when we arrive in the charming hillside Tuscan town. I pull into a parking space and say, I kind of wanted to walk around and see what's here. If you want to check things out on your own, that's fine.
I'm good to tag along, he says.
Okay, I say, still not sure I have any idea why he wants to be here. We get out of the car, the doors slapping closed behind us. I hit the remote lock, then remember my camera and go back for it. The streets are cobblestone and worn smooth from centuries of people, just like us, walking through on days just like this. Small shops occupy either side of the street, and I wander in and out looking at original watercolors and oils in vivid colors. Ren does his own thing. Sometimes we're in the same store, sometimes not. At the top of the street, a wine store sits on the right. I walk in, peruse the many labels, some of which are very expensive. At the back of the store, an open entryway leads to a terrace overlooking a Tuscan valley that stretches out in front of me for miles. It is absolutely breathtaking. I lean against the wall, take out my camera, and begin shooting frame after frame after frame. With each one, I feel that old feeling of having struck gold, finding something uniquely lovely to capture within my lens. I hear him walk up behind me. It startles me to realize I know the sound of his walk. It hasn't registered until now. But it's a little unsettling to think I've already absorbed the details of him in this way. He stops beside me and says,
"Incredible."
"It is," I say. He sits on the wall, swings his legs around to the other side. "You might fall," I say, looking down at the 20-foot drop below us.
"Or I might not," he says.
I'm not sure I agree with his logic, but the view is too inspiring to resist, so I sit and swing my legs over as well. I lift my camera, adjust the zoom, and take some more pictures. "I love the trees here," I say.
"Which ones?"
I point at the tall, shapely rows lining a long pea-gravel drive in the distance.
"Italian cypress," he says.
"Yes." He points to a spot near the center of our view.
"That looks like a grove of olive trees."
I refocus my camera on one of them, its silvery green leaves glinting in the sunlight. The houses in the valley have clay tile roofs. Their stucco walls are earthly shades of gold and terracotta. "Looking at this makes me wish I could paint," I say.
"I'd like to see some of your pictures," he says,
his palms planted on the wall, his gaze fixed on the scene in front of us. I decide not to answer him, because if he's just saying it to be polite, I don't want him to feel obligated at some point to stand and leaf through hundreds of my pictures.
"Does that make you uncomfortable?"
"No, I just..."
"I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it."
"Okay, I agree, and decide I need to get better at taking compliments."
"So what's the plan for tonight? Please tell me we're not sleeping in the car."
I actually smile at the thought of it. That might be a little more possible for me than you. I was thinking I'd just find a place. He studies me for a moment and then says,
"Want to tell me why you had to get out of Florence so fast?"
"No," I say softly.
"Jewel heist?"
"Me?" He lifts his shoulders in a questioning shrug. I laugh, surprising myself. "No."
"You're CIA?"
This time my laugh is more of a snort. I clamp a hand over my mouth. Stop. He keeps his gaze on the valley in front of us, his tone serious now.
I'm assuming it had something to do with last night.
Can we not go there?
We cannot,
he says and turns around on the wall to stand.
I'm going to buy a bottle of that great wine out there and ask the person up front for a hotel recommendation.
I look over my shoulder to watch him go, and it's hard not to notice his appeal. The dark, slightly wavy hair sticking out from under his ball cap, his wide shoulders, and that loose, self-assured walk. He goes over to one of the wine cases and stands reading the label. I notice a woman watching him from a corner of the store. Her eyes convey clear interest. I make myself look away because it's none of my business who looks at him. I start taking pictures again, but seem to have lost my focus. I climb off the wall and walk back inside the store where Ren is now at the register paying for 2 bottles of wine. The pretty Italian cashier states the price in euros, and I blink, wondering if I misheard. Ren hands her a credit card and says,
Can you recommend a hotel somewhere in the area?
She looks up at him, then glances at me, smiles, and says, Expensive or not?
Interesting, he says.
Villa Florentina. It is 4 kilometers from here. It is a home that belonged to one of the most well-known families in the area. 5 years ago, it was made into a luxury hotel. Many things to do there.
Okay, Ren says. Thank you.
He picks up the 2 bottles of wine. We head out of the store and start back down the street toward the car. Did you buy the vineyard or just those 2 bottles? I ask. He gives me a half smile.
I like good wine, and I'm willing to share.
All right, then, I say.
20. Ren. I find the Villa Florentine on the GPS, and it takes us about 10 minutes to get there. We turn off the main road onto a pea gravel drive lined with cypress trees. I realize it's one of the houses we saw from the wall at the wine store.
Wow,
Lizzie says, looking up through the windshield at the tall trees.
If I were a painter, I'd have to pull over and capture this, even if it took me a month.
You can do that with your camera.
Would you mind?
Of course not. She pulls the car over, gets out, and grabs her camera bag from the tiny back seat. I wait while she aims her lens in every direction at various angles. I see her nearly instant absorption and the way she connects with what she sees. The longer I watch her, the more I realize how much I am enjoying observing her without her self-conscious awareness. She walks back to the car a few minutes later with a look of chagrin.
Sorry,
she says. I didn't mean to overdo it. I like your passion for it, I say. She looks instantly surprised by this.
Thanks,
she says softly, noticeably avoiding my eyes, as if she thinks I'm just being polite. I reach over and touch her arm. Really? She meets my gaze then, confusion clear on her face. She battles with it for a moment, and then releasing a breath, says,
Thank you.
She pulls back onto the road, the driveway leading up to the villa that is now a hotel a half mile or so long. It appears to be a real find. The villa is enormous, its finish that weathered gold so popular in the area, the clay tile roof a perfect complement. Large old trees lay claim to the length of time the villa and its adornments have occupied the space. I had called ahead to make sure 2 rooms were available. They are expecting us when we arrive at the front desk. The woman who greets us has long black hair. Her earrings are the big loopy kind, and her smile is bright and welcoming.
We were able to get you adjoining rooms. I hope this is all right.
There's an awkward pause of silence before Lizzie and I answer in unison without looking at each other. Yes, that's fine.
Wonderful,
she says, taking a set of keys from the wall behind the desk.
I will show you.
We follow her through the lobby and up a very wide, winding set of travertine stairs to the 2nd floor. The rooms are in the middle of the long hallway. She opens the first door, and I wave Lizzie inside. The woman then opens the other door, and I thank her and hand her a tip.
Grazie. If you need anything at all, call the front desk. Please, enjoy your stay.
I lift my suitcase onto the luggage rack, unzip it, and pull out a few things, including the leather shaving case at the bottom. I take it into the bathroom and open it. It's only in seeing the bottle tucked into one corner that makes me realize I haven't been thinking about it. I plant my palms on the edge of the sink, look at myself in the mirror. For a little over a day now, I haven't felt the leaden boulder on my chest. The realization comes with a jolt of surprise. Is that why I talked Lizzie into letting me come along with her? Whether I was aware of it at the time or not, I guess it is. I have no idea how or why, but something about her makes something in me remember who I used to be. I take a shower. About an hour after we've arrived, I carry one of the bottles of red wine and two glasses to Lizzie's door and knock. I hear something drop, a yip that sounds very much like a curse. She opens the door, her hair still poofy from the blow dryer. She's rubbing the top of her foot with one hand. What happened? I ask.
Hazards of beautification. I dropped the flat iron on my foot.
I try not to smile. Did it burn you?
No, I'm fine. Just not very good with beauty tools.
I would argue that you don't need them. Her eyes widen, and I again watch her struggle with the question of whether I am serious or joking. She quickly changes the subject with,
"According to the information in the room, there's a great-sounding restaurant downstairs."
Want to start this bottle of wine and then eat there?
Sure. My terrace?
Following you.
I'll be right there,
she says, and ducks into the bathroom. I walk outside, enjoying the cool night air and the quietness of the countryside beyond the hotel. I love the peacefulness here, the fact that life doesn't feel as if it's zooming by too fast to even begin to take it all in. I think of how I used to thrive on doing as much, getting as much, being as much as I possibly could. It's as if a switch has been flipped in me, and I wonder how I ever wanted any of that life. When Lizzie comes out, her hair is straight and smooth. I noticed not for the first time that the color is like twists of peanut butter and caramel. It's both thick and silky, and I feel a sudden and overwhelming need to run my fingers through it. As a diversion, I pull the wine corkscrew from my back pocket, the cork making a satisfying pop. I run the bottle under my nose and let her do the same. She says.
I don't know very much about wine, but that smells really good.
I pick up a glass from the wrought iron table between us, fill it halfway, and hand it to her. I then pour myself one, set the bottle down, and walk to the wall that looks out over a softly lit pool below us. She raises her glass.
To Tuscany,
she says. To Tuscany. She takes a sip, considers it for a moment, and then says,
That is amazing. How did you know to pick this one?
From my last visit and doing a little reading.
You read a lot.
I tip my head. That's what I did instead of going to college. We got started with the band after high school. I tried to do both, but it didn't work out too well.
I'd like to say I know a good bit about your band, but I'm afraid I really don't.
I'm relieved to hear it. She smiles and says,
Got a lot of skeletons in that closet, huh?
A few.
Want to bring any of them out?
No, I say. Definitely not. She sits in one of the chairs close to the wall, crosses her legs, rests her elbows on her knees, and takes another sip of the wine. I pull up the other chair and sit next to her. For several long minutes, we don't say anything. We just sit, sipping wine and looking out at the incredible view in front of us. When I speak, it's to admit, there hasn't been anyone in my life in a very long time I can sit beside and not feel obligated to make conversation, even when there's nothing meaningful about it. She looks at me and says,
Thanks.
It's really easy to be around you.
I'm a fairly normal girl,
she says, and her smile seems a little forced. I don't think you're normal at all, I say, realizing there are any number of ways she could take that assertion. But she seems to take it in the way I meant it and smiles at me. I don't know whether it's the wine or attraction that sends the surge of warmth through my chest. I'm pretty sure wisdom would dictate chalking it up to the wine.
21. Lizzie. We finish the bottle in the room before heading downstairs to the restaurant.